going to talk about this wave optics features in exosolar planet observation by gravitational microlensing. And if half of my talk is some introduction to the exosolar planets and the methods, since this is new in PI. And the next part, I will give a technical talk. But before my starting, I want to have a few seconds silence to the people that did that died near my hometown Tabriz in 2 consecutive earthquakes, and many people died. So just a few seconds. Okay. So the question is that why extrasolar planet is important? So this comes back to the very deep and fundamental question that are we alone in the universe? So our planet supports life, and we know that life is in our planet. And the question is, are there any places in the universe that we can find such a planet? And as a cosmologist, we can do a simple calculation. In the horizon size, we have 10 to 21 star. And if for each star we assume 10 planets, then in the horizon size, in our horizon, we have 10 to 22 planets. And so it's, as a physicist, it's infinite. And infinite number. And the question by de Bruno that arises this question that if the universe is infinite, so there should be some worlds similar to our Earth. So that's a very exciting time to maybe answer this question in future. So, a brief history of the exosolar planet in the modern cosmology starts in 1995 by the observation of a star in the Pegasus constellation. So, these two astronomers took the stars in this constellation and then looked to their spectrum of the stars. And For this one that's shown in by the arrow, they observed that their spectrums moving back and forth. And this can be described by a planet that's moving around the parent star. So the planet shakes star around the center of mass. And each time you will see blue shift and red shift. And this curve is the velocity as a function of the phase of the orbit. So knowing this, the period and also the amplitude, we can have an idea about the mass of the planet. In this system, in this case, we have degeneracy between the parameters, but you can put a constraint on the mass of the companion. Object, and in this case, the conclusion is that there is a planet. This is phase, and this is a meter per second. So if we take data of the extrasolar planet data from 1992 to present time, so you will see that the number rise exponentially. So just up to 1st of the August 2012, we have 777 extrasolar planet that discovered, and it will goes at and with it, the number will rise in future, and hopefully we may find some habitable planet. How long? you can extrapolate. Okay, so this is the distribution of planet in terms of the mass in Jupiter mass. and same major axis. And you see that there are clumps of the observations, are clumps of observation in this parameter space. And this is mainly biased by the observational methods. That's why you are seeing the clumps here. And this is not exactly the real distribution of the planets in this parameter space. We should debias it according to this observational efficiency, detection efficiency. So mainly we have five methods of the extrasolar planet detection. I explained the radial velocity. The second method is a transit. We have a star and a planet, and you are observing in this direction. And each time a planet blocks part of your parent star, and it's like eclipse. So you can find out this existence of planet and also find the parameters of the planet. And if you combine these two methods together, you can break the degeneracy and find all the parameters of the planet. Third method is microlensing that I will describe later. Direct imaging is the reflection of the light from a planet, so you directly see the planet in your observation. And the last method is the astrometry. So you have a face on orbit, and when the planet moves, orbits around this parent star, it shakes this parent star, and if you do astrometry, you can find the existence, you can find this planet. And Gaia will do as a part of the a byproduct of the Gaia will be this astrometry and finding these extrasolar planets. And each method is sensitive to the part of this parameter space. So this is the mass of planet, and this is the temperature. So temperature, so this means that it's close to the parent star, and this is far from parent star, so in terms of temperature. And microlensing is sensitive to this part. This is habitable area, just roughly. And this is transit, and this is Doppler. And also, this five method is sensitive to the distance of the planet from the Earth. So, for instance, transit and Doppler wobbling are sensitive to close stars because we should have enough photons from the star. And the microlensing is sensitive to the distant stars. So by microlensing, you can see planets at the center of galaxy or kiloparsec far from the Earth. Yes, sensitive. By transit, you can see the planet here, because the eclipse will be very small. So the area that covers the star gets smaller. Angular. This is the angular size.
I think, so there's much a smaller region of the orbit where you could have.
So the time, transit time is shorter, and the area that covers is smaller.
Could you say something more about the relationship between the understand
axis? The main effect is the transit time. So the area, so since the star is very far from us, if you move the star, planet, it doesn't change so much to how much it covers this planet. So the main effect is on the transit time. Yeah. Sorry.
Could you say something about the relationship between the axis of the orbit and the temperature?
So this one. So. The closer, this is close to the parent star. This is higher. This is higher temperature and close to the star, parent star.
You mean in terms of radiation from the parent star?
Yeah. It's proportional. It's a parallel relation. And I come back to the Niash question, that the other effect is that, so if you put the planet here, so each transit takes a few years, okay? So it's longer than your observation time. But here, if you put the planet here, you will see with the orbit of a few days, you will see every day, every few day that you see a transit and it repeats. So. Yeah, period is very important also. Yeah.
Because the actual time to cross the star is always just the velocity.
Yeah, yeah, and
the time is actually longer
It's long. Yeah, it's.
Each transit lasts a longer time, and also the period is.
But it happens much less often. That's the problem.
Yeah. Yeah. The main effect is the period of the. Okay. Okay. So let's ask the about the habitable planets from very very large scale. So our universe at least supports life because we are here. So it can be explained by fine tuning or anthropic principle. Anthropic principle is a observational bias. We are sitting in a universe that we are exist in it. So universe supports life. In a smaller scale, in a galaxy, let's see how which part of galaxy supports life. So there is an interesting work in Science 2004. They study the evolution of the galaxy as a function of the age of the galaxy. So this is the present time, and this is 10 giga years before, and this is distance from the center. So they wanted to see which part of star and when galaxy can support life, which part of galaxy we can have habitable planet. So at the center of galaxy, we have supernova, very at the long time ago, at the early stage of the galaxy. So this kills life, and then at this part, 5 to 10 kiloparsec, this far from the center, we have low metallicity, and it can produce planet. So we need star formation, and 5 giga years ago, we can have an area that can produce planet, life at the present time. So we expect to see. So our expectation is that the life is in an area 5 to 10 kiloparsec from the center of galaxy. There is no hope to find life here, and no hope to find life very very far from the galaxy where the metallicity is very low.
Two metal here.
I don't know. The point is that maybe life started to evolve here. So the question is that when the life start to form. I mean, if we back to the past, when the life start to form. So here. We made some planets that the life just started to form, and we'll have it in future. But I don't know exactly if we increase the metallicity, what will affect on what is?
Does it have an effect on planet formation? Too metal rich means no planets.
I'm not sure. Yeah, I'm not sure. Okay, And if we take each star, around each star also we have habitable zone. So it's defined according to having liquid water. So depending on the type of star, we will have different habitable zones. So as according to Kepler studies, Kepler is a survey that observing planet that discovers planet according to transit. One third of the FGK stars in their catalog, they have they are located at in the habitable zone. So next step is to find some biological signs, signature from this planet. And this is a list of the planets from the Kepler, and this is Jupiter, and this is Earth. And for instance, Kepler 22 is located in the habitable zone. It's orbiting around similar to the parent star for this system is like the sun, exactly the sun, like the sun. And the size of planet here, this is the size of planet compared to our in-year planets in our in the solar system. So I'm going to. This one. It seems that it's right. Yeah. So it's close to this. So this planets are rocky planets. They just measure the size of the planet. Okay.
They also have a mass.
I think by transit you can do this because transit just sensitive to the you can have a size and also distance from the parent star because it's sensitive to the size of the planet. I don't know for this case. So gravitational microlensing is a very interesting method. I will show why it's interesting, and I will go detail on this method. So lensing is the bending of light according to the GR. And I showed it before. So you can do gravitational lensing in the laboratory. You just cut the bottom part of the wine glass and then look at the ball passing behind this wine glass. You will see that we have a double image, and then we have Einstein ring, and then double image here. So you can do microlensing in laboratory. And in the large scale, gravitational lensing is something like this. So in the galactic scale, in gigaparsec, the galaxies bends the light of the background galaxies. You have arcs here, Einstein rings, like this. And the method of the gravitational lensing for extrasolar planet observation is performed inside the galaxy. So in this case, a star lens another star or a planet lens the light or bend the life of another star. So inside the galaxy, first time Einstein did a calculation in 1936, and the conclusion in his paper was that there is no chance to detect this phenomenon because the probability is 10 to minus 6. 1 year later, Zwicky told that in the cosmological scales, we can have gravitational lensing. We have a good chance to see this effect. And in 1986, so according to the development of the telescopes and application of CCDs in the telescopes, Palczynski proposed that we can observe gravitational microlensing and we can use it to detect dark compact objects inside the halo. So in this method, each time you monitor the background stars, millions of background stars, and computer measure the flux of the stars each night and then find this gravitational lensing. So the gravitational lensing is something like this. We have observer, lens, and source. And in the absence of lens, light travels on this dashed line. And if you put the lens here, light goes like this. And if you want to, when we can find the position of the image as a function of position of source, and this is called the lens equation. So we can define a Fermi potential similar to the Fermi potential that we have in ordinary optics in the in this case it composed by the first term is first term comes from the geometric contribution, and the second term is the Shapiro delay term. And the stationary point of this thermopotential gives us the Lenz equation. So theta is the position of the image, this is the position of source, and this is psi, the derivative with respect to the potential. So this Lenz equation is a map from the source plane to the image plane. And so in this map, we can ask, so this is source plane, and this is image plane. So a source maps in the image plane here or here or here, somewhere in the image plane. We can have multiple images. And the question is that how much this differential element expands in this mapping. So this can be obtained by the Jacobian of the transformation. And in the case of microlensing or lensing of a star by another star, we can observe this, we can resolve these images. And the effect is just expansion of the area of the source. So this 1 over Jacobian is the area of the image, area of the differential element in the image plane divided to the area in the source plane. And for the single lens, we can have two solutions in two sides of the lens. And if we put this Jacobian of transformation 0, this gives us infinite magnification. So this point in the source plane is called caustic point or caustic line, and the corresponding image of this caustic line or caustic points in the image plane is called critical lines. Okay. So in the single lens, if we put Jacobian of transformation equal to 0, you will get Einstein ring, and this corresponds to beta equal to 0. Means that if we put the source just behind the lens, we'll have Einstein ring, and then magnification is infinite because this is a map from zero dimension image to the one dimension ring. So in the single lens, we'll have this is a source, this is a lens, and this is the lens plane. This is the images of the lensing, and since inside the galaxy, lens, source, and observer moves with respect to each other, we will see such a magnification. So just keeping in mind that the flux here is constant, and when the area is expanding, we'll get more light from the source. So it's very similar to the optical lens. And for this light curve, our parameters are t naught. T naught is the time for the minimum distance between source and lens. T is the transit time, and the u naught is the minimum distance. And t naught is time corresponds to the minimum distance or minimum impact parameter. And this is the one real image. Real light curves from microlensing, and since the gravitational lensing is independent of the frequency, the ratio of this is 1. Okay, so if you look at this three parameter, only one of them has the physical information in it, and that's the transit time. So transit time or Einstein crossing time is the ratio of the Einstein ring divided to the transit velocity or transverse velocity. And this is a function of the velocity, mass, and distance of the lens from the observer and observer. So the Einstein transit time is a function of transverse velocity, mass, and distance. So if we find the gravitational microwave, we can say what's the mass, where's it, and what's the velocity. But there are methods to break this degeneracy, like parallax effect. This is a second order effect, and the orbital motion of the Earth around the sun deviate a little bit this light curve, and we can find this can break partially the degeneracy. And also finite size effect is also another method to break this degeneracy. So, and other methods that I'm working with every on this topics is that we measure directly the images. So if we solve the lens equation, we'll have two solutions, and the distance between these two images is a function of the impact parameter and Einstein angle. So the distance, if we measure the distance between the two images at the minimum impact parameter, we can find the Einstein angle. And now Einstein angle is a function of mass and distance. This is a function of two parameters. And on the other hand, we have the Einstein crossing time. And then we can measure the distance of the lens according to the Maxwell distribution of the stars inside the galaxy. So we can get the distance, and if we know the distance and the Einstein angle, then we can get the mass of the lens. So this is, for instance, it's very difficult to see here, but just imagine that we made the observation and measured the distance between the images and measured the Einstein ring. This is a distribution function for the mass of the lens. And if you put a constraint here and define a black hole, you say that, okay, after 2-3 mass, I define it the black hole, you can say that this microlensing event with this probability is a black hole. Okay? And, or you can find mass function with a given distribution function. So what people are doing in I return to the extrasolar planet. What people are doing in the extrasolar planet observations? We have two main survey telescopes. They are covering a big area of the center of galaxy and measure the changing of the flux each night and alert to the smaller telescope like this Danish telescope that I'm part of this collaboration, and this group doing a follow-up observation of this microlensing candidates. So in the case that we have a binary lens, in the lens plane, I have one lens and a second lens, and just increasing one more lens increase the parameter space from the 3 to 6. So alpha, so this three parameters defined in a single lens, and alpha is a new parameter, is the direction of the source with respect to this two lens. Q is the mass ratio, and V is the distance between the two lenses. Now we can write the Fermat potential for this binary system. So this is the geometric term, and this is the Shapiro terms. This is planet term, and this is the star term. And if we find a stationary point, we'll get a five-order equation, and in some areas we'll have three solution, and some area we have five solution. And the interesting point about the binary lens is that if we calculate this Jacobian of transformation, if we calculate this Jacobian of transformation, put it zero, so in the single lens, we will have the one critical or caustic point. This is beta equal to zero. In the binary system, so this is single, in the binary lens, so we will have a curve, something like this. And when source cross this lines, we will have infinite magnification. So if we plot the flux as a function of time, we'll have something like this. When it crosses this caustic line, we'll have infinity here, and then like this, and then next time, again, we have a singularity here, and like this. So, but since our sources are not point, and they are finite size, so we will not have in reality we don't have such a singularity. So we have a very high magnification at this point. So this is a sample of this binary system. So in the binary system, in the source plane, we have these caustic lines, and when the source crosses this caustic line, we will have such a huge magnification here. Okay, so this is just a close picture from this this peak. And the physics of this caustic lines is very similar to what you are seeing in the normal optics. So, for instance, if you swim in the pool and look at the surface of the pool, you will see such a shiny lines that moving, and this is just a print, just the effect of this caustic lines. So what's happening in the pool is that waves meet on the surface and make such a shapes, and when this light crosses the surface of the pool, you will have same shapes on the light curve, and the effect on the surface of the pool is so produce singularities here. So the same thing happening in the binary lensing, so in the astronomical scale. So this is one of the samples of the planets. One of the first planets that discovered by the microlensing. And until now, we have 14 extrasolar planets, and these are some examples of the extrasolar planets. So you see that you will have, sometimes your caustic is very complicated like this. So here you have four caustic crossing. So 1, 2, 3, 4 caustic crossing. No. So depending on the distance between the planet and the star, you can make complicated caustic. So this is this one. So you can have caustic lines like this. So the topology of this. So we have three different topology for these caustic lines. So it depends on the distance of the planet from the star, you will have different topologies. So one of the channels this is the standard channel for extrasolar planet detection, and the other channel is the high magnification event. So in this channel, you have a star, and this is a planet, and the source, so this is a star, and the source star, and this is the lens plane. So source just crossed very near to this star. So you will have a standard light curve, but it will deviate due to the presence of this planet here. So you will have perturbation on the single light curve. So this is a okay for a subset of this planets, we know exactly what's the detection efficiency. So for each planet, we have the mass and semi-major axis, and this is the data from this 14 planet. And for this white dots, we know exactly what is the detection efficiency for these cases. And for this case, according to the detection efficiency, you can recover the number of planets that really happens in the around the stars. For instance, 70% of the stars pass the Jupiter mass, 52% has cool Neptunes, and 62% has supermass planets. So we have error bar here because of the Poisson statistics.
What are those counters in that?
So counters are the detection efficiency. So if we have a given number of the planet, we assume a given number, just 0.4 planet can happen here. Okay, so I'm sorry. If we have 100 planet with this parameter in this area, we can see only 0.4 planets. So if we observe one event, then you can normalize it to the real number of the planets. Okay. So this is a new paper in Nature, 2012. And another important discovery in last year was done by Moa collaboration in Nature, 2011. And they reanalyzed their database and found very short microlensing events. So this is in terms of day. So you see that the transit is less than 1 day. Okay. Sorry. This is Julian day, and this is. This is. This is day. So it takes. So this is. You should add to this digit. So 4,294. So this takes 2 days and another 2 days. So the transit time for these events are very short. They found 10 short, very short microlensing events. And detection efficiency for the very short microlensing event is very low, because in the observation you have big gaps here and you can see such events in this area. Okay? And for instance, in this area also you have a gap. So if you have a microlensing, very short microlensing event, you can see these events in this window. And detection efficiency for these events is very low. And again, if according to detection efficiency, if you normalize it to the real number of the planets, so the first question is that what are these objects? They can be free floating planets, free floating inside the galaxy. And their numbers is 1.8 times the bounded planets. So we can imagine that we have more planets in the galaxy, unbounded planets, than the bounded planets. And they escaped from the systems due to gravitational interaction at the time of planet formation. So most of the planets just escaped from the system.
Size
of the... No, they can be. You can constrain on the mass, but not a Cooper belt object. Yeah. So the transit times goes like square root of mass for the gravitational lensing.
Okay.
So you can compare your transit time with the standard solar mass planets and then get this mass. No, it's not just interesting for the search for life. This is just a discovery that you have an unbound planet. And there's a nice video in the YouTube. And I think it's very nice to see this. So you have this is the center of galaxy, and you have a very short magnification here. Takes just a few days. And in the closed loop, this is the lensing, this is the images, and then you get one of them. So we can see this lensing in the gravitational microlensing. And this is the planet that produced this lensing.
Yeah, right.
So freezing world. Okay. So, we recently done a work on the wave optics feature in the binary systems, in the binary lenses. And the idea is that in the lens plane, so if you have a binary lens, if you have a binary lens, we can produce a very close by images on the lens plane. So we have the source, and this is the observer. And we put two lenses here. One is a star, another one is a planet. And in some cases, we can have a very close images on the lens plane. And the idea is that if we have a coherency in the phase of this two images here, we can produce in the observer plane the diffraction pattern. So this is like a Young experiment, but in the astronomical scales, in the very big scale. So the very close by images can produce here around the planet. So here you can produce an image here and here at the time of caustic crossing. So this happens at the time of caustic crossing. So when this source cross this caustic line, this is the caustic line. This produce images on the image plane. So you can have an image here and here. So in some cases, these two images are very far from each other, and they are not coherent. So they can produce the diffraction pattern. But sometimes you can have images around this planet, and they are very close to each other. They can produce this diffraction pattern. So this is, as I told, this is like a Young experiment. You have a source here, and the pinholes here, and the pin, and here the gravity of the lenses plays the role of pinhole. They produce images here, and then you can find the amplitude of the light on the observer plane from this integral. So in this integral, f is 2 times wave numbers times the Schwarzschild radius times the Fermi potential. So if I expand this Fermi potential around these images, the first term is a constant, is a number. Second term is 0 due to the Fermi principle. Third term gives us the magnification of the light according to the geometric optics. So by this term, you will have this pattern in the light curve. And the higher order terms is the contribution of the wave optics. And this is one of the numerical calculation that we had done. This is the magnification, this is the amplification as a function of the time in hour. And this is we took a finite size source, and here we have a caustic crossing. We have a caustic crossing here. Source crossed this caustic line, and this solid line is obtained from the geometric optics until this term, and the dashed line is results from the wave optics contribution, higher order terms. So we expect to in theory we expect to see oscillation of the light at the time of caustic crossing, and this is what we expect to see this on the observer plane. So this is a diffraction pattern, and here is the observer plane, and observer is seated here. Here is the Earth, and Earth moving in this plane. So the observer will see this increasing and decreasing of the light when it's crossed this this pattern. So, one of the crucial points about this diffraction is that we know that the source, star as a source, is especially uncoherent. So the point is that, can we have a coherent light here? Or is there any temporal correlation in the phase of this image on the observer, on the lens plane, to produce this diffraction pattern? So here, from each point of the source, we get light on the lens plane, and in order to have a correlation in the temporal correlation in the phase, the distance between these two line should be less than wavelength. If we have a laser source, that's fine. We can have extended source, very extended source. Okay, so because the coherent time for the laser is very long. But for a normal source, the coherent time is in the order of the wavelength divided to the speed of light. So for the normal star, this difference between the path should be less than wavelength of the light. So if we do calculation here and put the star at the 8.5 kiloparsec, with the Earth's mass, and if we have a main sequence star here, then wavelength should be larger than 10 centimeters. So in order to see this diffraction pattern, we need larger wavelength. Okay, short wavelength doesn't work because in this case, difference between these two light rays is larger than this wavelength. Or if we have a laser or if we have a major source in the sky, then we can work measures is longer wavelength. If we have a measure, that's excellent for this work.
Can we see main sequence stars at this wavelength?
No, and this wavelength. Yeah. If we have a red giant. Yes, in this case, we should increase the size of this.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. We should go to the longer wavelength.
Factor of 100 or so.
Should go to the radio wavelength. Yeah.
So that's going to be like 10 meters.
And the other point is that also we should have temporal coherency on the observer plane. So if you have a two image here, again the length, the time difference between these two rays should be less than coherent time. So this is the coherent time. So the time difference between these two light rays should be less than coherent time. And again, I don't go to the detail of this calculation, but at the end, this delta t, the time difference between the two light rays, is given by this term. It's a function of the Einstein crossing time, mass ratio of the planet to the parent star, mass of the star normalized to the solar mass, and this is the time, approach time to the caustic. So tc is the time that it crossed the caustic line, and t minus tc is the time the approaching time to the caustic. And again, 5 times 10 to minus 9 seconds is equivalent to 15 centimeters. So we need longer wavelength. We need to go to the radio wavelength to see this. Or or we should have recurrent sources in the sky, some major sources. So there is analogy between these two physics, gravitational microlensing and Young experiment. So the potential, gravitational potential plays a real role of the slits, and we should check the temporal coherency and spatial coherency in these two systems, similar to what we are doing in the Young experiment. So the source, for instance, size of the source in the Young experiment can be large. So if we have a source here, so in the Young experiment, we put a slit here and make a very small source, and then so we put a pinhole here, and this is our slits, and this produce this diffraction pattern. So if we increase the size of the size of the source here, pinhole here, then we lose our this diffraction pattern. Same is that happening in this, I mean, this is similar to this one.
So I remember in your meeting with Avery brought up this point that it seems like you're being too hard on yourself with this wavelength limit, because you can take two telescopes, put a delay line in one of them before interfering.
Mm-hmm.
Two telescopes,
mm-hmm.
Two optical telescopes, let's say, and then you feed them together and interfere them. But if you just put a delay line, you can delay it by effectively meter and meter.
Mm-hmm.
One telescope.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So what's the result? So you are saying that we take two telescope or one telescope? One telescope and then delay the light and then make it.
I'm imagining taking two telescopes and then let's say the two images are arriving with total path length difference corresponding to 10 meters.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
But now you have two telescopes and you have two fiber optic cables coming out of two telescopes, and you put a delay line, effectively 10-meter delay, on one fiber optic cable before you combine the light from two cables into one. So then now when you're combining the light, you're combining the light from one image with the light from the other image.
But we should know
the delay where they are. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I'm not saying it sounds like it's terribly.
Yes. But.
It's not that hard to do. So it's all very complicated when you talk about the two telescopes, but you could just say, let's do a temporal autocorrelation. And that's what you do. So you take the signal and you shift it to time relative to itself, correlate it, and then you draw a picture and you know, hit the right time delay.
In
they do PLPR, they do cross correlation to two stations with the delay.
Okay.
But if you don't have a coherent source, how does this help you? Or maybe you're talking about a different kind of strength.
It is coherent over roughly one wavelength, one wavelength. It's just not coherent for 10 minutes.
So what Latham's talking about is step.
Mm-hmm.
So what's assumed here, at least as I've understood it, is that you're assuming that the delay between the two images is less than one period, wave period, and so you get the interference, or whatever it is that they're comparing over. But this isn't necessary. You still need to have spatial coherency in the source. This I agree absolutely with. But with the temporal coherency, I think.
Temporal coherency, how you resolve this?
Well, so if you try to look at the brightness, total brightness now, you won't see an oscillation. But if you look at the total brightness that then you'll be seeing the destructive interference between the two images.
Mm-hmm.
And in the radio, so an important thing to remember in the radio is that you're in this very high photon occupancy limit, and so light is really classical. So they're not measuring the total brightness, they're measuring phase widths.
Okay.
So you can do all of your interference classically. And so you're measuring phase fronts. You imagine I'm going to compare phase fronts now and phase fronts a little bit before. Okay, and this is a perfectly well-defined, straightforward process that you do all the time.
Okay.
And so in this case, the phase fronts before are going to be a combination of the primary and secondary image. The phase fronts now are going to be a combination of the primary and secondary. And what you're cross-correlating is that bit of the total image that was the primary now and the secondary before.
So we'll discuss later in detail.
Yes.
Okay, and so if we look at this caustic lines for this different category of the close resonance and wide lenses, as I said before, we have different topology of this caustic lines. So the close caustic lines has a topology like this. And the resonance is like this, and the wide image, so wide lenses is like this. So in this cases, we can find some areas of the caustic line that is shown by the green light, green color, that we can produce this diffraction pattern. So it means that when the source crosses this caustic lines in this area, that the image is already close to each other, and then that can produce this diffraction pattern. So like this here, so we have two caustic crossing here. It's behave like a geometric optics, and then in this point we'll have a wave optics oscillations. Okay, so I'm finishing. So we can test this wave optics observations in the gravitational microlensing as a function of the mass ratio and the distance, projected distance between the lens and between the star and the planet. And we are sensitive to the systems that are located one Einstein. So this is normalized to the Einstein radius. Located in this area, is one Einstein radius from the parent star. And the idea is that to see with the SKA or with present telescopes, maybe. We should go in detail on the, I mean, we should work on the observation part. And the whole idea is that if we are able to if we may measure this wave optics features with the radio telescopes, and this can break the degeneracy in the six parameters of the binary systems, and that this can this provides us the parameters of the planet with better accuracy, and we have optical telescopes for the microlensing, and then we can put radio telescopes that accompanying this optical observations. Okay.
Radiation from Jupiter and Saturn solar system is plenty of radio. Whether or not that's bright enough to actually find life far from our lights,
but in terms of exoplanets, I know there was this 1990, there was like this early 90s detection of an exoplanet on a pulsar. Besides that, there's been no
19.
No,
yeah, first detected exoplanet is 1992, was around the pulsar.
Yeah.
Yeah. Orbiting pulsar.
But that's maybe the only, so far that's the only appearance of planets in radio astronomy. I mean, apart from exoplanets.
But I mean, this is not, I mean, they're not detecting planets in radio. The source is radio, or the planet, of course, you don't see the planet directly.
Right. In other words, is there any other, do radio telescopes feature anywhere in exoplanet besides that original, the suggestion, or that original pulsar?
I don't know. No, I think no. Because the conventional methods, transit and Doppler, are using the visual wavelength.
Are there small radio sources that you could have a planet in front of a small radio source? If you have a radio source that is very small, the size of a star, then you could have a planet in front of the source, and you could observe that. And the planet would transit in front of a radio source.
Radio source.
So what is your small radio source?
I have no idea, but yes.
That's the problem.
Okay.
Yeah.
I don't think they actually measure the luminosity or the flux very well. I mean, what is the best precision for flux measurement in radio astronomy? I think it's like percent or so, which is not very good for like detecting transits, because you want like 10 to minus 4 precision.
Absolute flux measurements, is that what you're asking?
Yeah.
They do much better than that in relative flux measurements. They're much larger dynamic ranges than one order of magnitude or two orders of magnitude. They feel the eye do a lot better than that. You're not going to feel the eye. But I'm not sure. I mean, it's different between your ability to measure high precision flux measurements relative to yesterday.
But that's what you want, right?
Europe, right?
So, when you say relative, you're relative from one time to another time, and yeah. you think that's very good?
No, so I think there's a difference between knowing relative fluxes on large time baselines and knowing them on short baselines. Short baselines, I can certainly do very early. I'm not quite sure.
Probably the problem is due to the atmosphere. What's the recovery?
Yeah. The ability to calibrate out all the things that affect the
atmosphere. I remember talking to this woman who was visiting from Australia from SK, and it's like, how well can you measure functions in the SK? She said it's just a few percent. But I mean, I don't know, like, whether it was absolute or relative.